They're building a wall, and at such a cost. Land, money, and safety, and all the lives lost. A wall made of brick, but bricks can be broken when the people of Zion have finally awoken and said no more walls, no more refugees, no more keeping people up on their knees. And then the history books will someday recall, before apartheid was ended, they were building a wall.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, we feature an interview with from the program Law and Disorder with journalist John Pilger about his recent article in Counterpunch called Why the Rise of Fascism is Again the Issue.
We speak today with John Pilger, who is one of the world's renowned investigative journalists and documentary filmmakers. He's known for his conscience and bravery and acute historical insight. We talked to him about his recent article in Counterpunch magazine titled Why the Rise of Fascism is Again the Issue. Using the word carefully, Pilger describes a new kind of fascism centered in America but based on the big lie and a wars of aggression. We get a historical perspective from Pilger, going all the way back to the end of the Second World War. If you think the wars in Yugoslavia, Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, and now the Ukraine happened by happenstance, you are mistaken, says Pilger. These are part of an American effort to become the global power. John Pilger has worked in many facets of journalism, including as a correspondent in the Vietnam War, the Middle East desk for Reuters in London. His articles appear worldwide in newspapers such as The Guardian, The Independent, The New York Times, and The Los Angeles Times.
John Pilger, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
John, we were intrigued and excited both to talk to you about a new article that you wrote that appeared in Counterpunch called Why the Rise of Fascism is Again the Issue. And It was an extraordinary article, really summing up, you would say, since 1945, what the United States in particular has been doing around the world. And if you could begin by maybe giving us your overall thesis of that article and why you're talking about it as a form of fascism.
Well, I think it's about definitions, and it's about the way we look back on fascism and its Nazi iconography. I mean, I've always been very cautious about using the term fascism because it is so associated with Nazism, but it does apply to I think the rampant role of United States administrations and their allies since 1945. I mean, actual fascism that is very much like Nazi fascism was set up throughout Latin America, first in Brazil, then on to Chile and Argentina, and right through that suffering continent. Fascism, Nazi fascism, was created by the United States and, of course, throughout Central America as well. But a more, let's say, subtle kind of fascism is an insidious kind of fascism, now runs right through U.S. policy, especially as its dominance is challenged. It was always there, but now that its dominance is challenged, especially by two powers, not as great as the United States, but one certainly in economic terms rapidly becoming great, and that's China, challenged to some degree by Russia, but challenged most of all by the fact that we're in a period where the old imperial neo-colonial period is being seriously challenged by a post-colonial period. I mean, that's exactly what this new invasion of Yemen is about. If you look at all the countries that are lining up with their U.S. weapons and U.S. logistics and U.S. backing to attack this impoverished, divided country, they are all colonial creations, creations either of the earlier powers, like Britain and France, or of the United States. Saudi Arabia is the absolute epitome of this. So that, as I see it, is what the present state of the world is. We're moving into a struggle between basic, almost 19th century imperialism and its hangover, and something of a new order. That new order, we don't know exactly what it is, but it's represented by new economic powers such as China, undoubtedly a resurgent Russia. The fear of Iran is really that Iran is at the center of this new order. Not that it's backing countries like Yemen, which it isn't, but that it has refused to surrender its independence. So it is colonial societies, colonial-backed countries versus these new orders that has produced this almost ferocity that is now becoming a kind of fascism everywhere. The overthrow of the government in Kiev in Ukraine, although turned upside down by Western propaganda, was part of that. The fact that Obama has lied that he's leaving Afghanistan when in fact he's staying in Afghanistan. And as I say, this new war in Yemen. War and aggression is the essence of fascism. The Nazis certainly demonstrated that to us. And the disregard, of course, for human life, that is very much a feature of U.S. policy throughout the world.
And you might want to add the big lie to that as well.
The big lie accompanies everything. It's the big lie and an insidious propaganda that inverts reality, inverts the truth. For me now, and I've been a journalist for quite a few years, most television news, most news, in fact, is unwatchable because I then have to sit in front of it and deconstruct it or monitor it at the very least, but there is no option of gaining any information from it or knowledge from it.
If you just tuned in, we're speaking with John Pilger about his recent article in Counterpunch, Why the Rise of Fascism is Again the Issue.
So the big lie has insinuated itself right throughout the media. The big lie has worked in Afghanistan. The big lie worked now famously in Iraq. And we now know that probably about the same number of people died in Iraq as a result of that big lie as died in Rwanda. So fascism's lies and its aggression and its manipulations throughout the world, and manipulations, at one point something like a third of the members of the United Nations, 69 nations, had been attacked by the United States. Sanctions, so-called sanctions, that rather benign word, has been imposed on more than a third of the world's populations in some form. So the lie plus violence plus threat plus manipulation adds up to a very modern, let's say, post-Nazi form of fascism. And I think it is absolutely appropriate now to use the word, if only to concentrate people now, those who understand and are worried by much of this, to concentrate their minds on what is happening in their world and to shake people away from the idea that fraudulent liberal leaders like Obama, who is one of the great liars and one of the real men of violence on the world stage, can solve this, can make this better. We're at a stage, I think, of critical self-awareness. Either we understand these movements, we may not be able to analyze it exactly and understand where it's going, but we understand these movements in the world, or we don't.
I'm tempted to ask you what the big lie was in a number of instances, Serbia, Libya, Iraq, Ukraine, Afghanistan, because they were all pulled off under the curtain of a big lie. And the other thing that I'd like to hear from you is what the real interests are that underlie the reason for the big lie. I don't know where to start because they've lied all over the world.
You're right. It's a landscape. I think, in a way, it is making the connections, isn't it? And I suppose that's what I've tried to do in that article and other pieces, is to make the connections, which should be glaringly obvious. I mean, you mentioned Libya. Okay. Now, in 2011, NATO, which is basically the U.S. Enforcer, it has no legal basis whatsoever to roam around the world attacking countries, and it does it illegally, actually. It launched something, almost 10,000 so-called strike sorties against Libya, and even on its own statistics, a third of these were against civilian targets. It flattened two cities, Misurata and Sirte. They were carpet bombed. The attack on Libya was absolutely ferocious. Now, the big lie was expressed by Obama when he said that we knew that if we waited one more day, that Benghazi, a city the size of Charlotte, could suffer a massacre that would have reverberated across the region and stained the conscience of the world. Well, that was nonsense. There was no massacre in Benghazi, and the whole notion of the massacre was based on the fabrication of a group of Islamist militias who were just raring to, had been Gaddafi's opponents for years, were raring for the opportunity, were handed it, and gave it to the news media, specifically Reuters. It can go back to Reuters, that they said there was going to be a bloodbath, a massacre like we saw in Rwanda. That was enough. And the so-called humanitarian intervention then against Gaddafi was failed. Now, that was a big lie. I mean, Gaddafi, in fact, had been going along with the boys in Washington and London and Paris and wanting really to get back into the game. But Gaddafi was always considered under grave suspicion because of his support for the real possibility of economic independence in Africa. He was prepared to use his massive oil wealth to underwrite with gold an African development bank, an African currency. Now, this was all very audacious and may never have happened. But certainly Obama apparently believed it because he went ahead and confiscated $30 billion from Libya's central bank, and that's what Gaddafi had earmarked to use in Africa. Now, if you look at Africa today, following that attack on Libya in 2011, the gates of Africa virtually opened for the U.S. It was already there. AFRICOM, the U.S. command, had finally got into Addis Ababa. And right throughout Africa, we've seen this mass bribing with money and weapons of regimes throughout Africa. There is a U.S. military presence in the overwhelming majority of African countries now. For the U.S., if you look at why they're there, well, they think that their enemy, their new enemy, is China. And perhaps it is in terms of economic development. China has done a lot of very useful deals with many African countries. It has built a lot of infrastructure. It has taken resources. It has bought up land. But in return, it has built roads and bridges and so on. The point is, it hasn't fired a shot and hasn't sent a single soldier into Africa. But they are the perceived new enemy. As we move on through that, the new big lie, which was uttered here in Australia by a U.S. admiral who appeared yesterday. They often come here because they get such a warm welcome.
Yeah, you can keep
and
them.
He said that there was a new wall of China being built across the seas of Asia. So Here we have a version, if you like, of Colin Powell's famous, infamous presentation to the United Nations Security Council, or Reagan's on the threat in Nicaragua and Central America about a Soviet presence in Central America. Here's the latest version called A New Wall of China Being Built. These connections are terribly important, and I say they're obvious, but we really need to make them and to understand them, otherwise we'll lose complete control of much of our world, many of our governments already.
John, I really appreciate it, and I was really interested when you mentioned Libya and you talked about an African bank and Gaddafi's ideas of going off really the U.S. dollar. And I recall that wasn't Saddam Hussein considering also not going off the U.S. dollar for selling oil?
Yes, that was a factor. I'm not sure it was the factor, but certainly that's a common story with so-called dissident oil-producing countries such as Venezuela and Libya and Iran and, as you point out, Iraq, that they threaten the dominance of the petrodollar. And I think that's part of it. There's no question that the Middle East would not be in the state it's in. Well, there are two reasons. Israel-Palestine is clearly at the center of it. But oil is and fossil fuels are absolutely critical to understanding this part of the world. There just wouldn't be the rapacious interest. And as you point out, when Saddam Hussein threatened to do this, that was almost the last straw.
Let's switch our attention to the Ukraine, because I think there's a fine example of American aggression and American lies. What do you think is the ultimate purpose of America's meddling in the Ukraine and having their government overthrown?
The ultimate purpose is to subvert and dismember Russia. Ukraine is an important borderland. Ukraine means borderland. So like a highway to Russia. The Nazis found that. They swept across it to the Soviet cities. Ukraine, of course, was then part of the Soviet Union. There seems no doubt about this, that the ultimate aim is that the disorder and division in Ukraine will spill over into Russia and provoke those elements in Russia that want to bring down the present Russian government. The baseline for this is independence. Whether or not you like the government is beside the point. Russia is a big independent country, as Iran is an independent country, as Venezuela is an independent country. Independence is intolerable. And on the scale of Russia's independence, it's very intolerable, because it stands at the gates to Eurasia. And at the other end of Eurasia, of course, is China. And Russia is seen as an obstacle to continuing, enduring U.S. dominance. It's not just dominance. It's seen as another voice. Again, that almost a post-colonial voice in the way that China is, in the way that even Syria is. Now, as I say, you don't have to approve of these governments, but that's the way they are perceived. In other words, overthrowing the Russian administration is, I believe, the reason for this absolutely disastrous U.S.-engineered coup d'etat in Ukraine, but above all, the encircling of Russia by a missile system, the biggest military build-up, which is the U.S. build-up, in Eastern Europe and in the former Soviet Republic since the Second World War. Imagine, just for a second, all this happening on the Canadian border or the Mexican border. That's what it is. And this open threat and provocation and isolation of Russia, that has been succeeded to some degree, but because the Western media doesn't really report the news, its failure hasn't been reported, and that is the coming together of Russia and China, the strengthening of relations between those two powers that are now presenting a new power bloc, the very nightmare that the United States has had all these years. So that's the cause. I mean, the failure, again, has been turned into propaganda. There's no question that it was NATO's and the U.S.'s ambition to seize Crimea, and there'd be a NATO base there had they succeeded in doing so, and they weren't successful. This is playing with fire, playing with nuclear fire now. I mean, if you read carefully what Putin has said and what his people have said, their whole narrative has shifted now towards the acceptance that they might have to defend themselves, and that could easily come down to nuclear war. That's why the recklessness of this Obama adventure, this latest Obama adventure in Ukraine, is almost breathtaking.
I always thought about Jimmy Carter, you know, he came in after the Vietnam War is over, so his hands were tied a little bit, and I always sort of liked him because he was a combination of weak and human rightsy, and there were no real wars that I saw under those 4 years that he was in office. And then you start talking a bit about Brzezinski and what his role was under Carter and, of course, what it has been going forward. So I'd like to hear you talk about that a bit.
Well, I remember I reported Carter. I reported quite a few U.S. election campaigns, and I think Carter was, Carter's 76 win was one of them. I remember the here we go again, all the hopes, and his undoubtedly a decent and reasonable human being. But on Carter's watch, when he was president, Kissinger, who was hung over into that administration...
He's still around. He's advising Scott Walker.
Yeah, I know. Well, I saw a wonderful bit of YouTube the other day where some very courageous young man tried to arrest him. And I was cheering, but unfortunately he wasn't taken into custody, so he's still at large. He sent illegally weapons to East Timor.
That's right.
The Carter administration. East Timor was invaded with Kissinger's nod to Suharto and Gerald Ford's nod to Suharto when they visited Jakarta in 1975. In 1976, when Carter came to power, the arms flowed. And it was a former, rather brave, CIA officer who appeared in one of my films, William Lichty, who was the CIA man on the desk in Jakarta and saw these arms flow in, and what they were doing to the people of East Timor where Suharto massacred a third of the population. So that happened under Carter's watch. But perhaps the most significant was the appointment of Brzezinski as National Security Advisor to Carter. So here you had this apparently very liberal president and this very illiberal National Security Advisor who in 1979, the last year of Carter's administration, persuaded Carter to authorize secret arms to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. And through the 80s, this grew into $500 million worth of arms. And, of course, the Mujahideen lit, really, the whole fire of so-called jihadism in that part of the world. So that began under Carter. And it began with Brzezinski, who, of course, is like Kissinger. The two of them have been gurus to various administrations since then. And Brzezinski's The Grand Chessboard, his book, is regarded by a lot of these think tanks as the manual for how you dominate the world. I'm afraid that, you know, one of the last obstacles is to knock over the good old liberal delusions about these people. Obama's ascendancy succeeded in virtually getting rid of the anti-war movement in the United States. because everyone fell on their knees and said that God has arrived, finally, the liberal God. And that was total nonsense as well.
I just want to recommend highly to people your website, johnpilger.com. It's remarkable. Of course, you can see not all 58 of your films on there, but I think you stream a number of them, as I recall, as well as a lot of your articles, books, etc. Highly recommended. And my last question, you end your article with what our responsibilities are and what we have to do as people who care about the issues you're talking about and how we can at least try going forward to do better. And why don't you talk about how you're admonishing people at the end of the piece?
Yeah, I think it comes down to ourselves. You know, you often get in audiences and talking about this, people saying, well, what can I do? Which is an extraordinary question, actually, in societies where there is a great deal of free information, like the United States. So people don't really have the excuse of not knowing, but you have to find out. That's the first responsibility, is finding out. The second responsibility is, and then identifying and calling lies of governments, the lies of presidents, understanding the propaganda, deconstructing it, and understanding it to themselves, the recklessness of warmongers, and not, if you like, intellectually colluding with them, or morally colluding with them. That goes on all the time. Good people do that. They collude with them. Oh, but it can't be that bad, that kind of thing. Because what is going on, really, with this propaganda and with this bloodletting throughout the world, done in our name, is that it represents a conquest of us. And if we allow that conquest, and it's a conquest of our minds and humanity, self-respect, our sense of ourselves, if we allow that conquest, in other words, and this goes back to so many great and awful events in the recent past, that if we remain silent, then the conquest succeeds. It's people understanding that if they're prepared to be actually taken over by this power, controlled by it and by its propaganda, then that conquest succeeds. That should be unacceptable.
With those wise words, we conclude the program, and we thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder, and we hope that you'll join us again.
Hope to see you soon, John.
I'll be delighted. Bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's about 9:57. We're going to go right to Air Cascadia in a moment. At 10:15, stay tuned for Flashpoints, looking today at the criminalization of poverty, also the battle over the continued U.S. militarization of the Koreas, also an update on the health of Mumia Abu-Jamal. At 11 o'clock, stay tuned for The Dirtbag. Don Smallman, curator of the Portland Eco Film Festival, talks about gardening-related films. Other topics include bees, composting, and the importance of hardening off your veggie starts. As always, Glenn will answer your gardening questions as well. And thank you once again, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a member yet, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking where it says Donate Today. Thank you for doing that. We have a couple of announcements to play, and then we'll get right to Air Cascadia today. Chris's guest is Ed Cheney of the Northwest Resource Information Center.
KBOO and the Quinta Street Theater are proud to present a music documentary that raises the bar for the genre. Arrows into Infinity, the new documentary about the life of jazz musician Charles Lloyd. Thursday, April 9 at the Clinton Street Theater. Arrows into Infinity takes us on Lloyd's journey from the heights of jazz rock royalty to his life in seclusion and back again. Arrows into Infinity, the Portland premiere, Thursday, April 9, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton, Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm. On the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Tune in Wednesday, April 8th at noon when KBOO's Rita Rega will be talking to the director of Arrows into Infinity, Dorothy Darr. You'll get a behind-the-scenes glimpse of the making of this important documentary of one of the most influential figures in jazz. That's Wednesday, April 8th at noon here at KBOO Portland.
At the Erez crossing, which is where you enter Gaza from. So apparently, when you go into Gaza, you have to walk until you get to the first town there. And apparently that walk is very dangerous.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of Indigenous Rights, Palestine, and Academic Freedom. Thursday, April 9th at 6:30 p.m. at Portland State University's Smith Center, room 338. Guest speaker will be Stephen Saleta, former Virginia Tech professor. That's Indigenous Rights, Palestine, and Academic Freedom, sponsored by Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights, on Thursday, April 9th, 6:30 p.m. at Portland State University, Smith Center, room 338. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.